You are Locked On Jets, your daily podcast on the New York Jets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
You are Locked On Jets. It is Thursday, January 25th, the year 2018. Thanks for joining us. I am John B. from GangreneNation.com. It's Mailbag Thursday on this podcast. We will answer questions sent to me via email and the comment section of GangreneNation.com. Thanks again to everybody who submitted questions this week. We got a lot of them. We'll try and answer as many as we can. Our first question was emailed to me by a listener named Mike. We've been seeing mocks of the Jets picking high in the draft this year. However, there seems to be a decent trading partner in the 20s that could be looking for a quarterback. I'm personally in the Bridgewater or Cousins camp. The issue with picking up either of these free agents is what line are we going to stick them behind? There, we had another year of bottom 10 offensive line play. Question to you is, if we get either Bridgewater or Cousins, would it make sense to try and trade with Buffalo for the sixth for their 21st, 22nd, and their third rounder this year and rebolster the line? I think in terms of trading back, because if the Jets end up signing Kirk Cousins, which I'm not sure they're going to do, I'm personally not in that camp. But if you sign Kirk Cousins, you are out of the quarterback derby. The money that's involved, you are committing to him a lot of money, and you're only committing that kind of money to a quarterback if you think he's your guy going forward. So you become a potential trade down partner with somebody if you sign Kirk Cousins, because you're out of the quarterback sweepstakes at that point. The tricky thing about Buffalo is, do you want to give a team in your division a franchise quarterback? A lot of the teams don't want to do that. I'm not a big I believe you make a trade that makes sense for you. I'm not a big believer in trying to block a team, you know, a division rival from doing something. If it's a trade that makes sense for you, I think you'd do it, but I'm not sure the Jets necessarily would. I think Bridgewater's a different story. I think if you sign Teddy Bridgewater, and I actually, of the free agent quarterbacks, I like Bridgewater the best because I think he has the highest risk-to-reward ratio. I don't think it's going to take a lot of money to sign him. I think he's got a lot of upside, and I think there's a decent chance Minnesota lets him go, rolls forward with Case Keenum. But Bridgewater comes with a lot of question marks when we're talking injury. You know, he hasn't played in 2 years, and there are questions about what his ceiling ultimately is. You know, will he reach it? So I don't think you can commit to Bridgewater as your starter. I think you still have to think about taking a quarterback in the first round if you sign Bridgewater. So I think Cousins, yes, you become a trade-down candidate. I think Bridgewater, no. Is it Buffalo? Well, I think the issue with Buffalo is, are the Jets going to be willing to trade down with a team in their division, give a team in their division a shot at a franchise quarterback? I feel like if it's a deal that makes sense for you, you do it, but I'm not sure the Jets will necessarily feel that way. Most teams don't seem to feel that way. Most teams are very hesitant because, you know, if Buffalo gets their franchise quarterback, then you, for the next decade, all you hear about is how the Jets gifted Buffalo a quarterback. Next question. If the Jets hire McCown as a quarterback's coach, could he be activated during the season in an emergency? So the answer, this was also emailed to me. Yes and no. So for McCown to be activated, he would have to be signed to the active 53-man roster. So if he retires and takes a coaching job, he's not going to be on the roster. So say you get into an emergency situation during a game where somebody gets hurt, McCown could not go into the game because he's not on the roster. He's not on the active roster for that game. Now, you know, the next week, could he come out of retirement, sign with the team, you know, on retire? And, you know, he would be a free agent at that point. So, yeah, he could sign with the team and become part of the active roster at that point. But he has to sign as a player. He has to be on the active 53-man roster. You only get 53 active spots. So, yes and no. No, like, not during a game. He can't just come in the middle of a game. He would have to be signed to the team before that game. But the next week, if he signed, yes, he could. Next question. Because Jeremy Bates runs a play-action-themed offense that requires a mobile quarterback, does that mean that the Jets now have next to zero interest in trading up for a pure pocket passer like Josh Rosen? I'm not sure I necessarily agree with the premise that you need a mobile quarterback for this offense. Now, I've been talking about this offense on the show, and I've talked about, you know, some of the features of the offense, and I think maybe if this is pertaining to something I said, perhaps I misspoke a bit. you don't necessarily need a mobile quarterback. It's something that adds an extra element to this offense, but I don't think you necessarily need a mobile quarterback. Matt Ryan ran this offense in Atlanta. I mean, he's more mobile than you think, but I don't think you think of Ryan as a spectacular athlete, a guy who uses his legs a ton. Joe Flacco, 2014, his best season came with Gary Kubiak in Baltimore. It was his best season of his career, and he's not a mobile guy. And it was, again, Kubiak comes from a similar branch of the runs a similar offense. So I don't think you necessarily need a mobile quarterback, to run play action. And I think the other thing is, what's more important, a quarterback who can play or a system? I mean, I don't think you can pass on a potential franchise quarterback just because you're running a certain system. I mean, any quarterback you bring in is going to probably run a number of different systems during his career. You have good coaching, especially at the quarterback position. You have to alter your system to what the quarterback does well. You have to build around. If you find a guy who's super talented enough to be a franchise quarterback, those opportunities don't come around very often. You can't just dismiss it because you're saying this guy doesn't fit our system. You make your system fit him, I think. So I don't think that this eliminates Rosen. I think the Jets, I mean, I don't, first of all, I don't think you necessarily need a mobile guy. I think it's something that adds an extra element to the offense, but I don't think it's something that's essential. And even if it was, I think you then it's time to think about how the other ways you run your offense, because it's a lot easier to tailor an offense to a quarterback skill set than it is to find a good, a real solid franchise quarterback. Next question. This pertains to a rumor that came out on Wednesday about the Jets maybe looking into hiring a run game coordinator. And the question is, in Seattle, Tom Cable was the offensive line coach officially, but was effectively the run game coordinator with a say in draft picks. If the Jets are going to be adding a run game coordinator like this, he probably would be the offensive line coach as well. That means he will be dictating blocking schemes too. Doesn't this effectively reduce the offensive coordinator to being a glorified quarterback's coach? I have to believe the run games coordinator's work scope includes the running backs. I think we're talking about the way the responsibility is divided when it comes to the game plan, then we're talking about what positions they're coaching. I think there is an element of that, but during the week, the coordinator comes up with the game plan for that week, and essentially what that entails is not every play in your playbook is on your sheet on Sunday of plays you could potentially use. You pick a handful of plays, you pick a certain percentage of the playbook to install during the week, and those are the plays you can call on Sunday during the game. So you don't have the full playbook at your disposal during the game. You pick those plays beforehand, and you pick them based on matchups, what your team does well, what it doesn't do well, maybe a certain, again, a matchup you want to exploit. So I think when we're talking run game coordinator, and these titles can, the responsibility can vary wildly even among guys with the same titles, but I think typically what you're talking about is if the Jets bring in a run game coordinator to assist Jeremy Bates or whoever they do bring in, that would be the guy who picks which running plays would be best for the given week. Because again, you're not using every single play that you have. You practice during the week a handful of plays that you're going to run during the game. So I think when we're talking run game coordinator, that's what that person would do. He'd pick out the best run plays that they're going to use that week. He'd pick out the options for the week, and then the offensive coordinator would make the calls. Again, it may be different depending on the way the Jets do this. There's no hard and fast rule that you're the run game coordinator. These are your specific responsibilities. But generally speaking, that's what it is. So you're picking out the handful of plays that you're actually going to use during the game. You look at the matchups. Next question. What's your opinion on this year's running back draft class? And which backs at the top of the draft do you think are good fits for Bates's zone blocking scheme? So I'm kind of at the beginning of where I'm evaluating these guys. So I've really kind of looked at five backs so far, and I like all five of them. And these are guys who tend to be the top backs in the class. Talk Saquon Barkley. You talk the two Georgia backs, Sony Michel and Nick Chubb. You talk about Penny from San Diego State, and Geis from LSU. And I'll tell you, I think that this is a very strong year for running backs. I like all five of these guys, and these are just the five I've watched so far. I mean, I'll dive into some more, and I'll give you the one caveat, which is it's still very early in the process, and the more I watch these guys, the more my opinion is apt to change, so that's all I can tell you right now. But I think any of those five would be really good fits within a zone blocking scheme. I think they all have good vision. Barkley is the guy who is probably going to go at the top of the draft, and I'm not sure I'm wild about Saquon Barkley in the top 10, and I've kind of changed on that because during the season I really loved him, and then I've watched him a little closer. See, during the season I'm just watching the game as an observer of the game. I'm not really keying in on guys, so I don't have as good of a view as I will later on after watching, you know, a game a second time when I'm just watching one guy exclusively. And I mean, I don't dislike him. I do think he's a good prospect. I don't think he runs with the authority a guy at his size should, so that's a concern with me. I'm not totally sold on the idea he's a Todd Gurley, Ezekiel Elliott, Leonard Fournette type of prospect. I'm not sure he's quite there. A lot of people disagree with me on that. But the other thing is, for me, is, you know, is he, even if he is the best back in this class, is he so much better than those other guys that he's worth using a top 10 pick on when I can get another one of these guys maybe in the second round? And I think, again, there are four guys I like that I've seen so far. I've watched five. I've liked all five. You know, the two Georgia guys, Nick Chubb, Sony Michel. Chubb is kind of viewed as the thunder. Michelle's the lightning. You know, Chubb's viewed as the power back. Michelle's viewed as the speed back. But I'll say this is, and that's accurate. Chubb is more of a power back. Michelle is more of a speed back. But Chubb is faster than you think. He's got a little more wiggle than you think out of your typical power back. And yes, Michelle is the fast guy. He's faster of the two. He's the guy who, you know, has that element a little bit more than Chubb, but he runs with more authority than you'd think for your typical speed back. So, and then the kid out of LSU I like Penny. I think this is a good class. I think you're going to have a number of opportunities to add a really good back if that's something you'd like to do. Next question. In the draft community, a lot of people seem to love ripping on the mock draft experts like Mel Kiper and Todd McShay. What's your opinion on the mock draft experts and mock drafts in general? I think that those guys take a lot of heat, and I understand some of it. I mean, they're not perfect, but I think they almost take a little too much criticism because nobody is perfect. And I mean, they do it for a living. They do it for a long time. They've been very successful. Both of them, and I mean, you look back, they do get a lot right. So I think, you know, they probably take a little bit too much heat, but that kind of comes with the territory. I feel like when you become an authority on a subject, you know, when you become like one of the experts on a subject, people kind of look to knock you. I remember back when, you know, when Mike Mayock first started at NFL Network and he wasn't as well known, everybody loved him, and now he's seeing a little bit more. You know, he's become less popular. People are more apt to criticize him now that he's become a kind of a household name. I think it kind of comes with the territory. The bigger you get, the more people want to tear you down. When it comes to mock drafts, I mean, I think mock drafts are, people are too hard on them. I used to think they were totally useless, and now I've kind of changed my mind. It depends on who you're talking about. I mean, if you're talking with one of the guys, some of these guys are really in the know. They're talking with teams. They're gauging the value of players. And I think these mock drafts, what they do is they tend to give you a pretty good ballpark of range the player may go. I think the mistake people make is they dismiss them as useless because, well, that guy didn't go number two overall. That guy didn't go number three. Well, the thing is, like, some of the picks are just totally, you can't foresee. And if you miss one pick, it impacts the entire rest of your draft. You know, there's a domino effect because if you thought that one guy was going number two and he doesn't go number two, well, then the team that's going three may pick him, which changes, you know, the guy that went three won't go to the team. So it's just one of those things. It's a domino effect. You get one wrong, everything's wrong. So I think in general, though, especially some of the bigger guys in the know who are talking to executives on NFL teams, they give you a good ballpark figure, give you an idea of where a guy's going, a player's general value. What I don't like is when, I'll tell you the one thing I don't like, is say like a guy is viewed as a mock, is a second round, consensus second round guy in the mock draft, and he goes maybe 10th, 11th overall, everybody rips it as a reach. That's not necessarily the case. Again, these mock drafts give you a general idea of a player's value, but they don't always tell you exactly where. There are always one or two guys who slip through the cracks. So just because a guy is mocked in the second round and maybe he goes top 15, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad pick, and it doesn't necessarily mean NFL. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's a reach. because it may just be that guy kind of slipped through the cracks and he actually is viewed as a top consensus top 15 guy on a lot of boards. And the same goes the reverse. You know, there's always some guy who's supposed to go in the first round in these mocks who falls to the second round and everybody says it's a steal. Well, maybe the NFL teams know something you don't know about his medical history, something like that. So I think they're good ballpark. They're good for a ballpark. You just can't take them too literally. So that's what I'd say about that. Next question. Are you concerned by Josh Allen's 56% completion percentage that no successful NFL quarterback has ever had in college? I think when it comes to quarterbacks, I think in general, but especially quarterbacks, you have to view stats with a grain of salt. And I think when it comes to college quarterbacks, stats are almost useless because you just look at who the top statistical guys are, how few of them actually pan out, because college, the difficulty of college offenses varies wildly. There are some players where the degree of difficulty is very low because they play in a good system and they play with a lot of talent. Mason Rudolph, the kid out of Oklahoma State, is a good example. Great system, great talent. He typically has to make one read and throw it to a wide open receiver. So you can't really use his stats. The degree of difficulty is very low. I will say, when I've watched Allen, the kid who's from Wyoming, I don't think I've ever seen a high draft pick who's had to execute plays on such a high degree of difficulty so consistently, where he's always under pressure. He never has a receiver get separation. I mean, he essentially has to deal with a pass rush and throw into a tight window on every play. So I don't know how much I buy to the completion percentage thing with him. I'm not totally sold on Allen, though. He's like one of those guys where I'm still not totally certain how I feel about him. I see a lot of potential in him because I think he has the highest ratio of, oh my God, you know, like, how did he do that plays in this draft? But there are some things that are concerning when you watch the film, and it's up to interpretation because I watch it, and I say, well, maybe that's just the teammate, you know, maybe not executing. Maybe that's just an issue because the offensive line failed, but maybe it's an issue because of Allen. It's difficult to separate the performance. And that's on some of these plays. So he's a guy I'm actually watching quite a bit at the Senior Bowl this week because, you know, he's going to have quality teammates. Now, this comes with its own tricky parts because you're running, you know, you're working with new coaches. You're working with outside of your normal offensive system. You're working with receivers with whom you have no chemistry. So there are your challenges this week at the Senior Bowl. But he's a guy I'm watching at the Senior Bowl. I think there are enough question marks on him that I see some suspect decision making, which, you know, maybe it's just the receiver ran the wrong route on a play, but there are some plays where I watch him on the film and I wonder about his decision making. I do wonder about his, I guess you could say his accuracy, maybe it's the 56%. Maybe that speaks to his accuracy issues, but I don't worry about the 56%. I worry more just there are certain plays where I see accuracy isn't quite there, but I also see a high ceiling. I'm not totally certain. I'm not sure how much I'd love picking him in the top 10, which is where we're talking about picking him. But I'm also not sure it's a terrible idea. It's one of those things I could probably talk myself into if the Jets did it. But at this point, I would much rather trade up for one of the LA kids than I would pick Allen. So I think that's kind of where I'm at. I'm kind of in between. The numbers itself don't really bother me. It's more, there are a few things on film where I'm not sure whether it's Allen's fault, but I'm not sure whether it's the other guy. It's just tough to distinguish, and though that uncertainty is what concerns me. And our last question, would you like to see the Jets sign a number one receiver in the free agency market? If so, which receiver would you target? I think the answer is probably different than I would have given you a week ago, because Robbie Anderson, of course, was arrested late last week and is facing some serious charges. Of course, those are just charges that don't mean he's guilty, but the whole this situation brings a lot of uncertainty to the table for the Jets. Where, you know, will Anderson be available for them? There are lots of questions. So I think receiver is more of a need than it was a week ago, just because of the uncertainty around Anderson. To answer your question, should the Jets sign a number one receiver in free agency? It depends on who it is. Depends on the deal, as always. The guy I really like is Allen Robinson from Jacksonville. You know, young guy, high upside, big time receiver. And, you know, if everything's okay with Anderson, I think he'd be a great fit for the offense. He and Anderson is deep threats across from each other. You'd have a tough time rolling coverage toward one of them to take away the deep ball because you'd leave the other open. Lots of room underneath for Quincy and Nunwa to work the middle of the field. he's the guy I really like. I'm not as wild about the other receivers. I would not pay Jarvis Landry a ton of money. I like Jarvis Landry, but I don't like Jarvis Landry at the amount of money I think he would take to get him. So, you know, I think it depends. Allen Robinson would be the guy I have. If I can't get Allen Robinson, I'd be much less apt to spend big at receiver. That'll do it for our show today. Thanks to everybody who sent in your questions. Sorry we could not get to all of them. We'll send them again next week, and we'll see if we can get to them then. This has been the Locked On Jets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and Spotify if you enjoy it, and please leave it a good rating in iTunes if you do like it. Hope you have a great Thursday. We will be back again Friday to close out the week.